Yes, hello. This is the Ultra Culture Podcast. I'm Jason Louv, and today I'm talking to Tobias Churton, who has written two biographies of Aleister Crowley, including his latest, Aleister Crowley, The Beast in Berlin, Art, Sex, and Magic in the Weimar Republic. Tobias, how are you? We're on the show.
Hello, Los Angeles.
Yes, hello. So I've just been sent your remarkable book, Aleister Crowley, The Beast in Berlin, by Inner Traditions, which is your second biography of Aleister Crowley. And this one focuses on a very particular time in his life, which is about the two-year period that he was in Berlin trying to kick off his career as a painter and experiencing the Weimar Republic and kind of interfacing with the local German occult groups. That's a very, very succinct summary, but is that about right?
Yes, I think he was trying to put his whole life and message on a new footing, and it was his last throw, in a way, of freedom. After his Berlin time, he gets almost stranded in England. If you can be stranded in England, I think you can be when you can't express yourself artistically. And Berlin was the last place where he could really let fly within the very limited means at his disposal there, and have some intellectual and cultural impact. But of course, all that was lost because of what happened after with the ascension of Hitler. So what I've done is reconstructed the Titanic of late Weimar Republic Germany and put Crowley in his proper place in it. And we can see it now for the first time. So it's almost like multidimensional archaeology.
Right. Excellent. So it's a fascinating period both in his life and in European history. And in a lot of ways, Crowley is always kind of reflecting the broader cultural world that he's in and still is reflecting that back to us in a lot of ways. But I'm curious, how much was he... he was kind of on the cutting edge there, the avant-garde, but you're talking about he has a certain period of freedom in Berlin. It kind of seems to me that might have been the only freedom available in Europe at the time. Is that the case?
Certainly the level of personal liberty which you could enjoy in Berlin was unique to that city at that time. In the late 20s and early 30s, very early 30s, up until the end of 31, Berlin was the freest city in the world and the most modern. And in terms of your self-expression of your sexuality or your ideological beliefs or your artistic and political ideals, the scope for self-expression was very, very great. And probably hadn't been anything quite like it since the Belle Époque in Paris. But it was very much more under threat than the decadent period of Paris. So there was this sort of looming shadow. People felt that it could all come to an end. There was an underlying fragility. So the volatility of Berlin in that period, I think, was remarkably apposite for Crowley's conception of a new aeon coming to birth out of the ashes of the old world. You've got modernity in its purest form in Berlin at that time. I remember seeing a piece of film, black and white film from I think about 1928-29, and it's Buster Keaton, the great Hollywood comedian and silent film director, standing in Berlin, surrounded by this uber modern overhead trains that look like they're out of Metropolis, Fritz Lang. And he's standing there sort of astonished, almost like a person who's arrived on another planet. And that sort of, it sort of gave me that. It was a city which would make a clown of you or a sage of you. It would make something of you just standing in it, because the atmosphere of dynamic change was so very strong at that time.
So this is a really fascinating period in his life for me, because he's really trying to get something going, and he's kind of been frustrated many times in the past. His life up to this point has been so varied. He had been a mountain climber. He had been a member of the Golden Dawn, and he had been through many marriages. And the first Crowley that people think of, I think, generally, is kind of in the past around the World War One era, where he's running around the desert with Victor Neuberg and publishing the Equinox. And that's kind of the occult Crowley that people think of.
It's amazing how short a period the Crowley that most people know about takes place in. And here was a man who was condemned before sort of the age of 26. Most artists are permitted a kind of early period of going too far and getting it wrong, and then those years are reinstated later as the folie de jeunesse. Crowley was condemned almost on impact on arrival in English society.
How do you mean exactly? Do you mean with the court cases?
Most of the accounts that I've seen of Crowley tend to focus on the fact that he bought his house in Beleskin, and he lived by Loch Ness, and he had a battle with the Golden Dawn. These were things that were happening when he was only just graduated from university. The vast scope of his life is often missed completely. And I think that's another reason why the Berlin years are so important, because they crystallize the later Crowley. And the later Crowley, to my way of thinking, is actually more interesting, to me anyway, than the mountain climbing, going to India Crowley that is part of. The problem was, Crowley had written his life story, his autobiography, which was published in 1929, just before he went to Berlin. And it stops in Cefalù in Sicily. And I think for most people's concept of Crowley, that's pretty well where it stops as well. So the story really only goes up to 1922 in his autobiography. He never wrote a further biography of the next 25 years of his life. So in that sense, that's been a joy for me to do.
Right. That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah. It's fascinating that you bring that up, because that is most people's conception of Crowley, because people do seem to remember that part, and then it's, and then he died in Hastings.
Yes. He's supposed to sort of die in squalor and all the rest of it.
Which is not true, apparently. Idea, right?
Yes.
That's not quite the truth. Is that?
It couldn't be further from the truth. This notion that Crowley was a poet maudit, a damned poet who rises with wealth, who then makes a pact with darker forces which lead him to plummet to the earth and then slowly disappear in squalor and horror, and dies forgotten in a some sort of awful place, allegedly in Hastings. This is a journalist's wishful thinking. His life wasn't like that at all. It went through amazing changes after he was kicked out of Cefalù by order of Mussolini, the dictator. I find his life after then is really rather heroic. His early life was heroic in the sense that he was trying to imitate a hero, Sir Richard Burton, and he was into world travel and exploring and producing beautiful books and generally being brilliant and outrageous, both. But after Cefalù, the heroism is quite real. He does fight for survival, but he wins this fight. This should be recognized. He overcame. He didn't die in a street, broken down, a drug-addicted moron who'd lost his skills. This is just not true at all. And in Berlin, we see a man in his mid-50s running down Kurfürstendamm in love with a 19-year-old girl from Los Angeles, from Santa Barbara, I should say, to be specific, who's an artist like himself and who's fallen in love with him and he with her. He's living with a flower child in Berlin in 1931. I mean, and very active. And he's taken on by two of the greatest art promoters of Berlin at the time, Karl Nierendorf and von Alfensleben, who runs an amazing organization which the Nazis destroyed called Porza, which is where Crowley, the only British artist to have a solo exhibition in Berlin in that period. And he's manifesting as what he really was, an artist. And I think we can... If we approach Crowley as an artist, we'll get much closer to the real man than the magus.
Well, that's fascinating, right? That of all of his immense output, his incredible writing and middling poetry and his instructional material and then his autobiography and so on and so forth. That's fascinating that you think that his art career is actually where he really finds his feet. Is that
I'm not so. It's where he finds the essence of his existence. He projects his real self in his art, and it's a non-didactic form. So we're seeing, as it were, his soul, or as he would say, he painted the will. His painting is—he's just seeing. He's seeing life in his purely as an artist. He's not ideologically trying to persuade. Mm. He's not advocating a theory or in dispute. It's his vision.
Interesting.
It's his vision of life, and that's I think is precious. And the few paintings that have come down to us. That have survived, you know, that the Gestapo didn't destroy, and that have come out are an indication that he was a truly modern artist. He wasn't this archaic throwback. This sometimes magicians are very often portrayed as nostalgic or how can I say romantic figures that are reacting against their era. Crowley's quite the opposite. He's in the turbo charge of modernity. And we see that in Berlin, what a modern mind he was. And that often when we misjudge him during the Edwardian period, which was his heyday, it's when he probably was the most energetic and he was the most willful in the art, both artistically but also intellectually. He's not always true to himself in that period. There is much more of the poser about him. And we get the real Crowley, I think, after the First World War, when he's on his uppers, when he's got to struggle. And he's had to learn many hard lessons about himself and the world. But the one thing he knows is he likes the modern world. In many ways, he's appropriate for it. He stood out like a sore thumb in the first decade of the 20th century. Mm. Somehow he's starting to fit in Berlin. And had it not been for the catastrophe of Hitler, his life and our knowledge of him would be very, very different. I'm sure he'd have been known primarily in terms of an artist who had an exciting and, how can I say, notorious early life.
Interesting. So it almost sounds like you're suggesting that the mature Crowley is Crowley the artist, and that everything we know of Crowley is popularly as the magician and writer is a precursor to that, or an immature period, or would that be oversimplifying?
It's not all. No, not entirely. But I think you can come to the other through the artist. If you come to the esoteric Crowley through the art, you'll have a more balanced picture of the kind of person he really was.
I see.
The trouble is, people look on the internet or something, and they see this picture, one photo taken. You know, in maybe in 1908 or 1910, where he's wearing costume from the then defunct Golden Dawn, and he's making horn symbols with his thumb, and that's the picture that stays because that's the most journalistically acceptable image. And Crowley, in some ways, underestimated the power of those photographs. He was having a bit of fun when he was whenever he was photographed. He was always having a bit of fun. But those photos are taken very seriously, you know, they're rather as if, because of their theatricality, they now remind us of pictures from horror movies or
right.
That sort of thing. So it's about correcting the image of Crowley. I think there's a lot of people out there who've gone through periods in life where Crowley's appealed to them for one reason or another, maybe the power of his intellect or some of his libertarian viewpoints are attractive, but there's always the feeling, yeah, but he was a bit of a this and he was a bit of a that, and he probably dabbled too much in that, and was he a drug addict, etc., etc., etc. And this image of Crowley becomes, well, I can do that the whole thing sort of thing. I think I would say that the precious insights that you get from Crowley are worth keeping, and they're best kept if you think of him primarily as an artist, but the kind of artist that was prevalent in Paris in the late 1880s, 1890s, which also was very theatrical. If you think of somebody like Joséphin Peladin, the great promoter and starter of his own Rosicrucian Catholic order, a remarkable man, he's almost a precursor of Crowley. If you start to see Crowley in terms of the decadent and the symbolist art that is coming through in Paris in that period, you just get a you'll be able to actually appreciate the other aspect, the esoteric aspect of Crowley, so much better. That he was operating on all these fronts. You know, and the word Satanism, for example, if you look at it in terms of Paris in the 1880s, isn't advocating something out of a Dennis Wheatley novel. It's a suggestion of a way of life which despairs of the world as it is, and in that sense confronts bourgeois, what they were, you know, the great enemy of that period for the artist was bourgeois Philistinism, an attitude that only money mattered, that your life could be measured in material terms primarily, and you should always be respectable. And Crowley, of course, would say, wonderful line, I think. He said, you can be respected or you can be respectable, but you can't be both. I think Crowley comes over in the Berlin years as a man worthy of the respect of people who know something about life. You know, that would be the qualification. If you know a bit about how hard it is to be an individual in a hostile environment, and to be an individual is almost always to be in a hostile environment, you get love and respect for this strange visitor to the human story.
Right. So sounds maybe not so different from the struggle today, and
it's the struggle. Yes, exactly, the struggle of every individual. Okay. But it's a romantic idea, of course, and modern, what we now call modern thought. It wasn't modern in the 30s, but it's a more modern view now to say that the individual doesn't really matter as an individual. You know, that we're just carrying on genetic components.
Right.
Well, I don't buy that. The genes give us the vehicle, but not the spark that makes it worthwhile.
And that's certainly a large appeal of Crowley to me, is the bringing that out, that individual spark. And I wanted to circle back a little bit.
Exactly right.
I wanted to circle back a little bit, and I want to touch on. I want to definitely touch on what Crowley has to tell us today. But I want to circle back a bit, and we had touched on the you know, the negative image of Crowley, which almost, you know, invariably seems to have to be addressed in any media about him. And one of the most fascinating things about your biographies, and also the kind of biographical renaissance about Crowley that's been going on with Kaczynski's Portorabo and some of the other, and to some extent Lawrence Sutton's book, is how much of the negative image of Crowley turns out to simply be fabrication, whether journalistic fabrication or, you know, from John Simmons' book. You know, I was shocked to read you know, many of these recent, you know, your biographies and some of these other recent biographies, and discover that most of the scare stories about Crowley were simply not true. And the image of him that emerged was, you know, of a kind of a bohemian, kind of, you know, trying several different schemes, trying to find himself, and often frustrated by the people around him, or maybe impatient with the people around him. But for the most part, there are no, you know, there's certainly nothing more shocking than the average behavior of the average, you know, young person today, I think.
Certainly today.
Right.
Certainly today. No, I mean, they were, I mean, every artist who wanted to be recognized was always out to shock, as they are today. In that sense, you're absolutely right. I mean, just the ability to shock. Crowley probably was a bit more shocking because he didn't only offend he didn't only appear to offend to some people the social mores of the time, but there was the religious aspect with Crowley. I believe what's really held against Crowley is that he was much more outspoken in his opposition to Christianity as he had experienced it.
Right.
And it is that which means that in the reactionary mind, in the Western world particularly, that marks him out as they won't allow him to be Percy Bysshe Shelley, who is outrageous in youth but eulogized in death. And no, Crowley must be seen to show that those who reject Christianity must come to a bad end. And if he didn't come to a bad end, then we must present it as if he came to a bad end. And anyone who is interested in him comes to a bad end. They don't ask this of Marcus Aurelius or any of the later the Roman emperors until Constantine, that their paganism should lead them to a bad end. But there is a cultural prejudice in the Western world that those who resist the atonement of Jesus on the cross, those who resist it, I have forsaken the consideration of the culture. And what is remarkable is that even though a large part of our educated cognoscenti today are not Christians or not really Christians, they still are prepared to buy a great deal of the medievalism of the older Christian culture, namely that if you don't go with the atonement, you must be working for Satan, you know. I found this very often as a strange superstition in the modern rationalist. They don't believe in God, but they're kind of afraid of those who do, which is almost, as I say, you know, they want to. I remember a famous British atheist scientist in this country made the sign of the cross to me at a salon one afternoon. because he was afraid that I was suggesting there was more to reality than genes and atoms, you know.
Right. Yeah.
In other words, I was saying that scientific measurement did not exhaust reality, and he immediately clicked that I must be a romantic believer in all sorts of what he would consider mumbo jumbo. So I think Crowley, of course, will always be in for that. If you could find, if they found one day that he was a good card-carrying Christian and loved Jesus and had confessed his sins and was sorry for all the bad things he'd done, then of course I think they'd be quite prepared to say that he was a pretty interesting character and allow a movie to be made about him. But Crowley really believed that the Christian era was past. Now let us be clear about that. That didn't mean he had no interest in Jesus or the teaching as he saw it, but he was one of the first to recognize, along with Carl Jung, the importance of the Gnostic tradition. And I think his view was pretty much, well, if Jesus existed, one component of the story was a Gnostic teacher, and he had nothing against that. What he couldn't abide was the kind of Protestant religion, particularly Protestant religion. He has much less of a beef with the Catholics, oddly enough, because the Catholics still believed in magic, effectively. But the Protestant tradition, which is that without accepting the Protestant format of the forensic atonement, the blood of Jesus, as being the salvific moment, if you don't accept that, you've had it, you're out. Yeah, it's that. This is the problem, really. It's no good me sitting here and trying to defend Crowley's individual acts. That somebody may say, you know, he let a woman down here. You know, he was not as friendly to this friend as some people might have been. They think the real essence of Crowley's challenge is that he was propounding a new religion or a synthesis of a lot of actually old traditions of spirituality. But this synthesis that he was proposing was revolutionary. And if taken up by a state in the Western world, because it's very unlikely it would be in the East these days, but if the Crowleyan synthesis of Thelema was actually taken up, it would be a fundamental change in the direction of human progress. And he was advocating that. And that's the threat. That's what worries people.
Of course, he displayed some initial interest with, I think prior to this time, with getting Hitler interested in the Book of the Law, but then
he only mused on that. It wasn't him.
Okay.
It was one of his followers, Martha Kuntzel. And she was under the illusion, as he told her, under the illusion that somehow Hitler could prepare the way for Thelema. And that he was saving the national will of Germany. And Crowley's view was, what do you mean? What is this national will bullshit? Mm. There's no national will here. We're talking, he said, he were talking about, basically, he said Hitler is an Old Testament prophet type who wields a magical power over people's negative hates and manipulates them. So, the idea that he did see, I mean, Hitler had said some things which suggested that he had some potential to launch a better Germany. But as Crowley realized very quickly, he was so overwhelmed by his negative, unconscious sides that, I mean, he was totally perverse. And as for his ideas about the Jews, Crowley regarded the Jews as the best things that had dignified and saved what was worthwhile in German culture. I mean, he outraged Martha by saying, that the average German was like a monkey compared to the Jews. Now, this is would hardly endear him to the racist, bigot, loony perverts, whatever you want to throw at those at the Nazi hardcore. Right. So no, he was, but he was interested in the idea of challenging the Catholic Protestant ideological domination of Europe.
And in a lot of ways, he's well in line with kind of the Rosicrucian and Freemasonic tradition in that way, which had challenged these, certainly had challenged the Catholic Church in Europe. Is that accurate?
Broadly so, yes. But Crowley wasn't the sort of person who advocated, you know, if you set up a new institution, imposed it on people, you've improved the world. He wasn't interested in that at all. His idea was that the thelemic idea would eventually sink into the subconscious of humanity because of its useful truth, i.e. its magical value. In other words, it worked as a principle. Mm. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law must seem to anybody who's unless they're a born sheep, as common sense. You know, you've got to find the divine in your existence and work with that and not interfere with other people's destiny.
Right.
I mean, it's a very commonsensical viewpoint. You could say, I mean, he often said, look, St. Augustine, one of the great saints of the church, said the same thing, love and do what thou wilt. St. Paul talks about the true Christian as being a man who is a law, or woman is a law unto themselves, because they love God, i.e. the highest they can conceive of, and they have love for their fellow man, and they enter a life of service of the highest. And Thelema is, he knew that Thelema had appeared in Rabelais' writings, and Rabelais was a good doctor and had been a monk. And it was an ancient principle, but it was taking thousands of years to be generated into a dominant principle, and it's still coming. The value of Crowley has yet to be seen. Mm. Although I think, when I think about the post-war world, I see a lot of very positive outcomes. I mean, if you look at in England, I obviously know a bit better, but we have a thing called the Butler Education Act, which came out in 1944, which said that the point of state education was for the individual to realize themselves. Now, we now take that as common sense, as normal, but that wasn't the attitude of education in the 19th century. When Crowley grew up under fundamentalist parentage, you had to whip the offending Adam out of the boy and instill the urge to obedience within the boy. And that was what education meant. It wasn't Platonic. Plato had said, education is a system of remembrance of our pre-mortal existence. And the arts and sciences bring us back to our spiritual nature. That is the essence of the initiation of life, life as an initiation. Mm. These principles you will find in mature masonry and in the mature Rosicrucian tradition, as opposed to some of the freakeries on that have grown up around it.
Right. Now, it's fascinating that you're saying this. And also some of the things that you were saying about Crowley's attitude towards Christianity and Gnosticism, there's an element of Crowley where his attack on social mores and his attack on Christianity, as you were saying, is really kind of an attack on the external trappings or the kind of sleepwalking state that might today be much more found in scientism, you know, as you had mentioned. But at this, but you know, with one hand, but with the other
I would just make this little point.
Mm-hmm.
What he's against is what he calls the slave gods.
Right.
Any concept, it doesn't have to be Christian, could be, as you say, scientism. Any concept which puts man under the whiplash of an alleged superior being. This is what his objection is about, is man being scared of being man. That's what he's against. His whole life was an assertion of man. And if that requires a bit of blasphemy to show that you're alive and you're conscious and you have a relationship with the universe, so be it. It was the slave gods he was trying to bring down, because the trouble with religions is there's usually a core of wonderful spiritual teaching which at some point enters our consciousness and we subscribe to it. But if you go along with the institutional religion, you will always, if you go along far enough, you will find that they end up being schoolmasters with a stick.
Mm.
And Europe had been living under this stick for nearly 2,000 years. And that stick was carried over to America to some extent, although in America you have this distinction of the state and religion, and it was a healthy distinction. You didn't have that in large parts of Europe. Hello?
Yes.
Jason?
Yes, you can still hear me.
Sorry, let's be clear, that's what it's about. That's what the argument with Christianity is about. It's not about whether you like Christmas or, you know, Easter, or you pray, or you go to church and you believe in angels and spirits and saints and all that. That's your business. If that's the way you reach your ideal, that's your business. It was the oppression of the soul that he was concerned with.
So one of the and I certainly agree, and I think that one of the scary things about Crowley is that he attacks that, and he attacks the kind of sleepwalking faith in the slave gods, as you might say. And with his other hand, he's kind of handing, he's not giving a comfortable dogma to replace it. There's certainly the philosophy of Thelema, but he's giving people a handful of very brutally difficult techniques, which very few of his students went all the way with. Including Neuberg and some of his Scarlet Women and things like that. You know, they weren't quite
up to
Crowley's level, right?
That's right.
Which would be very hard to pull off. And for people today assessing his teaching, you know, it's difficult because he's coming out of a classical education. There's Greek, Latin, Hebrew, you know, many different languages. You know, he requires a very you know, formal logic, scientific training, and then you get into the very complex, the complexities of Kabbalah and the physical difficulties of yogic training, which is kind of the work of a lifetime, and very difficult for, you know, people now, especially young people now who may be, you know, working full time to pay off student debt, or certainly don't have the leisure time that Crowley, as an heir of a small fortune, had. So that's kind of challenging, to say the least. And I think that's probably part of the, you know, he doesn't offer a quick fix. He shows you a tremendous problem and then offers you no quick fixes for it.
Yes. If you want a quick fix, I don't know really where you'd go other than to the chemist. Or as you say, do you say the drugstore, or is the drugstore just groceries?
It depends on what substance, but yes, the drugstore.
Well, we have a chemist where you go for headache pills or whatever.
Yeah, the pharmacy.
A pharmacy, you'd say. Yeah, pharmacy. So if you want a quick fix, go to the pharmacy.
Right.
Crowley was talking about the evolution of human civilization. He wasn't expecting, certainly not in his lifetime and not in our lifetime, that this these changes in fundamental premises of progress would be taken. He thought there would be a change, you know, within the next thousand years, you know, that sort of, it's that sort of idea. He's working on a very large scale. He's still in line with the Rosicrucian tradition that there are secret chiefs, that there are benevolent forces in the universe which are higher than the man in his physical condition, and that man's job, not every man, he never thought that, what he would say, the kings of the species, that they should get in touch with higher intelligence. And some of, a lot of his magic is about ways of getting in touch with higher intelligence and testing it. And I think anybody who's ever been inspired knows that there is something called higher intelligence. Now, if you say it's gray matter, then all right, you can argue whether is it mind or brain. You know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Our ability to think and conceive of the idea of brain seems to be much more important than the idea of a brain telling us what to think. There is a dimension of the human experience particularly, but I dare say it's in other aspects of nature, we just don't experience them, although some, I believe they do. We are aware of a higher light. Now, Christianity is full of doctrines about the light, and come Christmas, which is fast approaching, we'll hear all about the light. And in the beginning, there's a light and there's a word, there's a spiritual dimension which is made flesh and dwells amongst us. You know, this is the first mystery of thinking about life beyond the visible. Now, Crowley would say, this is so far so good. He would then say, I think that the church is to some extent have hijacked this whole sphere of life beyond the visible and turned it into something instead of which is uplifting, that very often functions as a dogmatic oppressor of man. But, you know, religions also evolve. Crowley was interested in the evolution of the species and what was going to change. So if you say to me, well, it's very difficult for people today to find the time to meditate or to concentrate for a minute on themselves and just think about themselves. I mean, I always love the thing he said, the trouble with many of my students, he said, is they're not selfish enough. If they actually cared about themselves as much as they think they do, they might find it a bit easier to do some real work, some real magical work, and get their lives aligned. But the world has always been full of distractions. If it wasn't getting a degree or getting a job, it would be getting something else. It'd be getting a card game organized or, right, you know, getting the garden. We can always put a billion things in the way. If you get up 15 minutes early, you can do an awful lot with 15 minutes, I found.
Yes, you know? Yes, definitely.
It's the will. You've got to have the will. You need the volonté. You've got to have the will to do it. Thy will be done, you know, on earth as in heaven. It's that link. Crowley's not addressing the democratic masses. He didn't believe in the democratic masses. He wasn't interested in the notion that the majority might be right. The majority, historically, he believed, was almost always wrong and had only ever been saved by a minority of far-sighted people who are able to lead the sheep in the right direction from time to time. The tragedy of democracy is we're always on the verge of having a complete lunatic in charge of the sheep pen. But it's hardly anything new to say that.
Well, it's fascinating to me that at the end of Crowley's life, which is recorded in Magic Without Tears, where, you know, despite this huge panoply of ideas and philosophies and techniques that he's recommended, he's deeply harping on that the core of his message is that there are higher intelligences, that it is necessary for humanity to contact them to advance its evolution, and that the Book of the Law is the proof of this. Now, for an interesting counterpoint to this, I was having kind of a debate on email recently with a man named Charles Upton, who is a Sufi scholar who wrote a book called The System of Antichrist, where he kind of takes the opposite tack, where he says that this is the exact problem, that humanity is constantly trying to contact higher or lower forces and intelligences, and that they are kind of meddling with human history and driving it in an anti-human direction. And I kind of think there's a lot of validity to that. Of course, I got into an argument with him where I was saying, well, what is the angel, the Archangel Gabriel appearing to Muhammad in a cave to give him the Quran? If not, you know, how is that different from an alien abduction experience, for instance? And, you know,
or Joseph Smith and his plates.
Certainly, right? And yeah. These stories are, you know, not much different from, you know, while these stories occur throughout the history of the world and, you know, and the reception of the Book of the Law, if one takes that as valid, is, you know, a similar story. So that, for me, is another one of Crowley's most challenging ideas. And certainly he provides things like Kabbalistic tests and things like that to verify the reality of such intelligences. But, you know, ironically for Crowley, that kind of puts a lot of faith in, you know, beings which, you know, maybe, you know, maybe...
I couldn't agree. I honestly, Jason, I couldn't agree with you more. I think the whole field of angel summoning from John Dee, Trithemius in the Renaissance, in the English Renaissance, onwards, I think addiction to such activities is perilous. I do. I'm much more with Peladin, the French mage, who believed the essence of magic is a way of life and an attitude to life, and that one should leave a surgic ritual to, you know, in this whole business of angel summoning. Not to be recommended. And I certainly don't think, unless you're a born angel contactor, you should mess around with this sort of thing at all, or be deluded enough to think that every sense of another consciousness that occurs to you is real or more intelligent than you, and so on and so forth. I don't think Crowley would defer too much if you said that the kind of intelligence we're talking about is actually your own. but he would say it's more convenient to think of it as a separate being in terms of invocation, so that you don't get obsessed. Because what tends to happen is that the ego, you see it with intelligent people anyway, that if they've written a book and people say, what a great book, their ego is inflamed. And within a couple of years, they're writing nonsense because they think that it came from them. This is I am a genius. I don't go wrong. You know, you can rely on me to tell the truth. The tragedy of man is that we, in the court of our brain, we can entertain all number of guests, and the ones we like, we tend to identify with, and we think we're the same as. And the end result of this can very often be a mental derangement. So. As I said, again, magic is not for everybody. An artist is a natural magician in many respects. And this has always been a problem. Who is initiated, who isn't? Who do you believe, and all the rest of it? Which is why I like the do what thou wilt principle, because first of all, you don't rely on others. But I think I don't think... There are many cases of people who felt they were in touch with a higher inspiration, shall we say, and who've done great things as a result. But they have to be, what is it Jesus said, allegedly? First clean the inside of the cup. If you want the new wine poured in, you've got to make sure that the old stuff is well cleaned out and the vessel is pure. And that is why you have this austerity of moral or ethical conduct. Thou hast no other right but to do thy will. This is an initiation. You're not talking about an educational program for every person here. Although the benefits of this way of thinking are of use to everybody, but I think there are different levels at which you can approach it, and I don't think playing magus in anything but the most serious sense would be a sensible thing to advocate. And in that sense, you can say, well, should books of Crowley appear in public bookshops?
Mm.
Well, I should say, so long as the people aren't forced to read them, they've got to be obtainable somewhere. And many people will gain enlightenment. I think as the culture develops, hopefully, in the long time frame, into people being more spiritually aware, we will, through experimentation, sort these many of these problems out. But at the moment, we're still in a kind of chaos, a chaotic situation where we have piles and piles of antique law that's suddenly becoming available to us in a very easy way. What would you say? You know, are we going to just avoid all this sort of thing, or are we going to start working with it? Those who can and who are, as I say, born to do it.
Well, it's interesting that you suggest to leave theological activities to the side, although the core of Crowley's system.
Unless you're a natural born Thurgis, my point would be.
Well, what is a natural born Thurgis then?
Well, you know, like in the old tribes in the North American Indians, or the Native Americans, as you've now decided to call them, you had certain families that tended to produce the medicine man, and whose training was different to the warrior and the hunter-gatherer and so forth. So you had initiatic traditions where people were raised in a particular way. And I would say that traditionally, there's something to be learned from that. There are natural-born magicians. Now, it doesn't mean that your father's a magician, you're going to be one. They would often take somebody in from outside. I mean, that's how the old priesthoods developed. Somebody would bring their boy to the local priest, magician, prophet, depending on the culture, and they say, my boy sees things. I can't do anything with him. He doesn't want to work in the shop. You know, he doesn't want to use a bow and arrow, but he sees things and he says remarkable stuff. And I think it's your kind of thing. And that young person would be taken on as the Thurgist and so forth. And so there was a kind of the society offered that tradition. Now, nowadays, all we've got is, because I was an ordinand when I was a boy, a young person. I wanted to go in the church because it was the only place to go, you know. Mm. So I went to the church of England. I said, I want to be a priest. Why do you want to be a priest? I said, because I'm aware of God and I want to practice that as a way of life in terms of service to other people. And they said, well, that's not good enough. I was constantly told, you know, you've got to be an accountant. You've got to be a manager. You've got to... You know, modern priests don't do any of that spiritual stuff. They just visit old people and are nice, you know, do the services and keep people feeling nice and secure and bourgeois and homely. And that's what priests are. And you don't fit because you've got all this other stuff going on. So, of course, I understand that problem, you know. You can't... The disciplines required for effective Thurgy require a certain amount of separation from the rat race.
Yes. Mm, yes.
You know, so, yeah, but it's very difficult to tell a teenager this, you know, who's 18 and has read a paperback about Crowley and suddenly decides to spend the weekend with his friends invoking some force or other because they rather like to see what happens. What can you tell them? You know, just careful, son. You know?
Right.
You might bite off more than you can chew here. But interesting, you know, you would want to know whether the person had a pure aspiration. Now, our current culture, the materialist culture, offers no social role for the spiritual person, it seems to me, other than card readers, you know, fortune tellers.
Yes.
You know, there are people setting themselves up on the internet and offering spiritual services, but the culture as a whole doesn't really have this role. And so you end up with a problem because how can they support themselves? So people start taking money, and we all know what happens. It becomes very problematic. People often feel, I paid this money to this person, and I'm now more screwed up than I was before. and you get the tribe of fakers and false practitioners. I personally can't solve that problem, and reading Alistair Crowley's books won't solve it either.
Right.
We are going to have to develop new arms of society. Now, back in the 30s, people like Rudolf Steiner back in the 20s period, it was hoped that the church, the freer churches, would take on the new spiritual knowledge. And that did happen to some extent. But there was always a sort of point of resistance. And you did have priests who were interested in Gnostic spiritual development, but they were very often quickly isolated and put down, and ended up having to set up groups of their own. And this sectarianism, I much favor the idea of a broad church with different colleges. Like, you'd have a college of Gnostics and a college of, you know, moral teaching and a college of this and that. But it's very difficult. And when I think about the United States, where you have this remarkable freedom in religion, but it's also circumscribed by the state and the state's power, you've got opportunities to learn. And, maybe you've got a better chance, actually, in the States than in Western Europe, where the institutional churches are still not in numbers strong, but still culturally strong. But I think that's changing too. The fact is, it's all changing, isn't it? And my view is that Crowley is a significant actor in the change of the world society, which is well in advance now, well in process, with all the reactions which one would expect. The hideous reactions to freedom,
right,
in the world.
I think that's certainly true. I think we just hit on the core issue here, which is the lack of not only spiritual or initiated traditions broadly in Western society, but the genetic, if you will, role of the shaman, and how that has largely been discarded by modern civilization. And because of that, the people who have this calling or, naturally gravitate towards this mode of life find themselves in the underground, on the fringes, kind of in the counterculture, and suspected and mixed up with, the seedier elements of society and yes. all of the inherent, problems that go along with that. That's a huge, very, very hard problem to tackle, especially in a culture that values only the latest technological gadget, money, scientism, materialism. And so I was fascinated by some of the things that you had said about how much value Crowley has for young people today. And, not just Crowley, but this whole broad range of intellectual investigation or practical investigation. But it almost seems like we're saddled with the rebellious image and kind of stuck in the adolescent rebellious loop with some of this stuff because of the necessity of kicking back against a society which is basically just made one profession illegal, as it were.
Yes. Yes, it's a great problem of the aeon of the child, as Crowley would call it. It is an aeon of the child with the positive side, the unrestrained reconnaissance of the world, the freedom of speech and activity. You've got all that, but you've also got this sort of immaturity of the child as well, the truculent aspect of childhood, and rebellion for rebellion's sake. Aspect and mistrust all forms of authority. They're all wrong. They're all out to get me, which generates a terrible paranoia, which can affect young people's development hugely. yes, I think Crowley and philosophy must be appropriated within a healthy lifestyle. I really do.
I certainly
and
agree.
And we must be clear what we mean by a healthy lifestyle. I think it's one that is based on a truthfulness and conformity with our nature. And a look to our better nature. And there are interesting examples. I think for many, of course, with these tendencies, the world of art is attractive. So we've had a lot of talented people go into cinema who have these instincts. I think of people like George Lucas and some directors who've got the gift of bringing newness and magic into life and art. I think they have their influence. But obviously, if we're talking about a changed world in the superficial sense, who's got the mineral resources will decide who owns the water, who has the petrol, who has the most missiles, all these things are the facts. But then again, I think of Jesus again before Pilate. Was it before Pilate or Antipas when he says, "My kingdom is not of this world," and we mustn't, you know, you cannot allow the encroachment of the visible world to entirely dominate your thinking in the field we're talking about, because that is only is important, but it has a relative value. This, all of this can change very, very profoundly. And very quickly, and who can predict the future? I think the principle of "do what thou wilt" and "love is the law, love under will" are ironclad, and will beat the crisis of consciousness that we've been going through for such a very, very long time in the world of trying to find a rational form of unrational truth. I don't like the word irrational. They always say magic's irrational. It's not unrational. Reason is in its place. It is not the only and dominant faculty that yes. we own. Gosh, I if I'd known I was going to have to give some sort of recipe for a better world, I think you and I both know that you can only do your best according to what you know.
Yes,
and it would be wonderful if somebody was in a position of great influence in government or something, if they got the message and there were sufficient of them to say, yes, well, we're going to put some of our energy into very positive things. But as it is, tomorrow's crisis dominates the headlines. But we have to get through all this.
Right.
And I think Crowley's when we recover the real Crowley, he can, if nothing else, he can give you a very humorous attitude towards living in this world and a way of coping with it that enables you to progress. But perfect society's utopianism, no, that's not on the cards. Not on the cards at all.
Right.
And anyway, one man's meat is another man's poison, as we know.
Yes.
One man's utopia is another man's hellhole, you know.
Yes.
So, don't let me ramble on. I don't think I'm saying anything.
Well, I think maybe we should just, you know, I think that one of the most fascinating things about Crowley is how much more relevant he becomes instead of less yes. relevant as time goes on, and his prediction of the Aeon of Horus, you know, I think is completely spot on, and you know, of the kind of the image of God as a terrible child, both growing and innocent, but also throwing tantrums from time to time, and it seems like, regardless of, you know, even if very few people have read Crowley or even practiced the techniques, the overall prediction, as it were, or of the Aeon of Horus seems to become more and more true constantly. And Crowley says that can, you know, that's certainly not utopia. Well, it could become a utopia, but we could also end up in a new dark age. And
well,
I'm not sure which way it's going.
well, I'd say we are, insofar as the light of spiritual wisdom is hard to see, then we are in a dark age. But the light of spiritual wisdom was there in the dark ages too. The nature of the universe, as I understand it, is binary. And so, in a way, the worst thing can happen is a very light period, because then you know that something pretty awful is likely to come up very quickly. At the moment, we have things like this Islamic State, and before the Great Fear was the communist state. And I just think ahead and think, well, what's going to be the next thing? There'll be something else. You know, there'll always be this foe that we're all supposed to be terrified of, and in many ways we should not be terrified of. We should deal with these things as they come, of course. But are we going in the right direction? Insofar as you're doing your true will and realizing the higher power on earth, you're going in a very good direction. You're heading for the one star in sight. And wonderful things happen. It's very interesting if you read the depressing writers through time. In many periods of history, they thought, it's the end. The children are rebelling. Nobody wants to know anything. Nobody reads anything anymore. It's not like it used to be. It's all going downhill. We've got crime. We've got social deprivation. We've got confusion. We've got commentators who've got nothing to say. We've got singers who can't sing, musicians who can't play, all of that. They've always been, the naysayers are always there, but at the same time, there's these yay-sayers, but you do have to look for them. Mm. I mean, I had the pleasure recently of discovering the works of John Zorn, who's a new, do you know him?
Yes, of course.
Well, you say of course, but in England he's practically unknown. But okay. I was lucky to make a contact, and I just thought, wow, it made me feel so much better. Dark Age, what am I saying? This guy's full of light. That's going on.
Yeah. Well, you'll have to visit New York. I believe it's still open. He has John Zorn has a art space in, I think, the Lower East Side, where they're just constantly giving improvisational performances.
You have a renaissance in New York. You have the light in New York, and I'm sure you've got something pretty well in L.A.
Oh, man.
And okay, Jim Morrison's gone now. There's bound to be a long aftermath.
I think there is a renaissance going on.
I think it's always going on because there's always people in the next generation who are insightful and gifted enough to catch on to the real electricity. I mean, there's always the trash. We know that. But for those, seek and you shall find. You'll always have to look for it. But I don't think it's the total dark age. But of course, we'd like, the house. If you look at a city from the air and you just see house after house after house after, we'd all love them to be turned on, and wonderful, and praising the higher power, and not obsessed and watching trash and the minds fill. And we'd all like to see that. But Crowley, you see, this is why people say, but Crowley wasn't democratic. No, because the progress of our species does not depend entirely on common approval. Mm. It's sad, but it's true. How many people were at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967? And how many people, were listening to very dreary old-fashioned music? The larger number were not listening to Jimi Hendrix and Otis Redding and so on. People now have this image that the 60s was a vast turn-on, but it's a terribly small number of people actually got the real essence. I mean, I used to know Derek Taylor, the press officer of the Beatles, and he lived in Los Angeles quite a long time. And I think he ran Warner Brothers, a big aspect of Warner Brothers Records at one point. And talking to him was fascinating about the real 60s and what a small and fascinating group of people it really was. And there wasn't this great social change that we're told existed. It hardly touched, there were centers of it. But even, George Harrison, I think, said he went to Haight Ashbury in 67 and was disgusted by it. He said he felt it was like the Bowery. All these poor kids had turned up there falling prey to exploitation and drugs they didn't need or couldn't handle. And end up someday going back home to Minnesota and sorry for the whole thing and whatever. It's never been the majority. We must build, those who are aware must build each other up and encourage the energy, not sit in despair about the nature of the world. I was very struck by Sir Crowley when he said, when it comes to it, I don't give a pack of cards for the whole human race. I think that's sort of is a necessary sort of feeling you've got to have sometimes and say, look, don't take it all so seriously. Yes, the planet could puff off in a puff of ash. I mean, not only would that destroy all the wonderful things we're aware of and enjoy, but it would at least destroy all the crap as well. But I don't think that's going to happen. He says, as an asteroid appears in the sky the size of Manchester. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's up to us in all the generations to build up what we can and use our energy to the best and do what thou wilt. And love is the law. They seem to me to be very good guides and be sincere in what we do.
Okay. Well, I think that's a wonderful message and certainly agree. So, follow your true will and you could find yourself at the center of the action, as it were. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
It's been a great delight, Jason, and thank you for asking such interesting questions.
All right. Thank you very much. And the book is called The Beast in Berlin, Aleister Crowley, Art, Sex, and Magic in the Weimar Republic, or rather Aleister Crowley, The Beast in Berlin, Art, Sex, and Magic in the Weimar Republic, and it's available now from Inner Traditions, and it was an excellent read. All right. Thank you, Tobias.
Thanks, Jason.
All right.